Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The stock market ended last week on an all-time high. Our country's GDP is hovering around 3% for the first quarter of the year. Unemployment is holding steady around 3.5%, near 50-year lows. Inflation is low. Interest rates are primed to fall again. Charlotte, too, is doing well economically, and North Carolina ranks third on a list of top states for business. And like the nation as a whole, our GDP, if there is such a thing, our GDP growth is up while unemployment is down. But we are also in the midst of the longest economic expansion in history. And recessions are inevitable. It's a law of physics that what goes up must come down. And some contrarians are worried. So should we be? We take a closer look at our economic good fortune, what's driving it, what may threaten it, with three people who watch the inner workings of all of this as part of their jobs. Mark Vittner is a senior economist at Wells Fargo. Welcome back.
Good to be back with you. Good
morning to you. Also with us in our Spirit Square studio are two reporters for the Charlotte Business Journal, Ashley Fahey and Caroline Hudson. Welcome to you. Good morning.
Great. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Good morning. Let me see here. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can even watch us this morning on Facebook Live. So, Mark, the stock market is not the economy. We all know that, but let's start there anyway. The market has been up and down this year, but last week it was incredibly positive, in great positive territory, with record highs on Thursday and Friday. Should we feel good about that?
Well, yes, we should feel good about that. The stock market discounts future cash flows, and so it's expecting the economic times to last a little bit longer, and they're very happy that the Fed is talking about cutting interest rates, and that last year the Fed may have gone a little bit too far in hiking them and raised them at least one time more than the markets were expecting, which gave us that awful market at the tail end of the year.
What's the prime rate right now?
Well, the prime rate is about 5.25%.
And what's the rate that the Fed charges the banks?
At the rate that the Fed charges the banks.
Where are their interest rates right now? Let's put it.
Well,
down.
The interest rates on the federal funds rate is about 2 3/8.
Okay, and that's remarkably low, isn't it?
It's remarkably low.
Yeah.
Globally, interest rates are much lower. And because interest rates are so much lower around the world, the dollar is strengthened, which has caused our trade deficit to widen further. And when you add in the trade disruptions tied to China, it's really slowed manufacturing activity. And that's kind of the mechanism that global economic conditions work their way into the U.S. economy.
So investors are encouraged by the possibility that the Fed will actually reduce rates as opposed to raising them. But some consider that madness. There's a website called MarketWatch. They wrote this last week. Stocks are hitting record highs and layoffs and unemployment are at 50-year lows, yet the Federal Reserve is prepared to cut interest rates soon because it's worried about the economy.
Well, monetary policy or changing interest rates work with a long and variable lag. And so the Fed's job is to get out in front of a slowdown in the economy. They can't wait till one actually materializes. And so they see enough evidence that things are slowing. And again, it's mainly because of what's happening overseas, but it transmits itself in the U.S. through manufacturing. And the manufacturing sector accounts for about 2/3 of the fluctuation in GDP. So when we went from 2% to 3%, about 2/3 of that acceleration came from the factory sector. And now it appears that we're going from 3% back to 2 or a little bit less, with most of the deceleration coming from the factory
sector. So this encourages investors. Why this decrease in interest, this potential decrease in interest rates? Why?
What? Well, I think that in terms of the business cycle, you can either have a hard landing or a soft landing. And a hard landing is a recession, and where we see economic activity slow in a much more significant way, contract. In a soft landing, the Fed cools the growth rate in the economy just to the point that the unemployment rate remains stable. And so the Fed's new posture on interest rates suggests that they're going to get it just right, and that we will see that the economy will, growth will moderate, but the unemployment rate will continue to trend a little bit lower.
So just before the possibility of lowering interest rates became a fact, I believe the I have the sequence of events right here, there were announcements of strong data from the jobs market, meaning that people were getting jobs, the unemployment was low, and that sent stocks lower. Why?
Well, because
that seems like good news to me.
It was good news, and I think some folks were worried that it was going to throw a wrench into the whole process, and that maybe the Fed would misinterpret that strength in employment growth and say, well, we don't need to cut rates. And the employment numbers are funny. They come from a relatively small sample. They tend to bounce around quite a bit. June is a big hiring month, and it really depends on the calendar and how many weeks you had between the previous survey, because you may pick up more new entrants into the workforce and teachers and students that are coming into the workforce in the summer. And when you seasonally adjust that, that tends to exaggerate it. So it wouldn't surprise me if when we get the July numbers, we see a payback. The average pace of job growth has slowed from 220,000 a month to 170,000 a month over the last 3 months or over the last six. And so we have seen that job growth is moderating. There's a whole lot of other technical quirks in the numbers. The floods in the Midwest actually boosted the employment numbers because relief workers, if they're paid or counted as workers, even though they're very temporary, but all the numbers are annualized and grossed up. So if you add 4,000 workers, when you seasonally adjust it, it may turn out to be 40,000.
One more question about the stock market and investors before we move this to Charlotte and here talk about the local scene for a second. The percentage of individual investors who say they expect American stocks to rise over the next 6 months has remained below its historical average, I'm told, for nine straight weeks. I've never heard of this before. I've never heard of this measure, but some believe that's good news in this decades-long bull market. Why would that be?
That is good news.
Why?
Because typically when your typical investor feels that the stock market is, when they become optimistic, that's usually a sign that the stock market is headed south. When the individual investors become optimistic, that's usually a sign that the bull market is over. So that is a good sign for the market that individuals are still a little wary. Why that is, I don't know. They have all sorts of things. They had, you know, the hemlines, and they have all sunspot theory. There's all sorts of crazy theories out there, but that's one of those sayings that has been around the market for as long as I can remember and does seem to have some bit of truth to it.
So perversity reigns supreme in the stock market.
Yeah.
Things look bad, that's good.
If you ever think you've got it figured out, you're probably in trouble.
So let's bring it home to Charlotte a little bit. We have Ashley Fahey and Caroline Hudson here from the Charlotte Business Journal, and they watch the local scene. What is all this gyration in the stock market and the fact that stocks finished on an all-time high mean to the Charlotte business community, if anything? I don't know which one of you wants to take that.
I'll take it.
Okay. Go for it.
All right. Basically, I mean, it means similar things that it does on the national scale as well. Obviously, when the stock market's up, that makes investors in Charlotte happy. And I believe we have maybe seven now Fortune 500 companies here that are trading publicly. So you can pretty much bet that when the stock market's up, so is Bank of America, so is Sonic, so is Sealed Air. And, you know, I think we have a good set of companies here that vary as far as industry across every sector here. And so, you know, there will be disparities, I think, depending on how one industry does over another. But overall, you have to consider that it's positive for Charlotte.
So the rubber meets the road for most people listening in their 401ks. When the stock market goes up, they're doing pretty well in their retirement funds and whatever other investments they have. When interest rates begin to fall, that's good news for a lot of people who are thinking about buying things like cars and houses. Will it help the housing market here? Because the housing market here is really tight, and evidently housing sales, despite the great economy, have fallen.
That's correct. Yeah. So we came off of 2017 and 2018 being super insane hot markets, right? We reached these new records on housing prices. Inventory was at an all-time low. Then we saw a bit of a cool down starting this year. Nothing too dramatic, but, buyers were able to actually enter the market and get in there a bit more aggressively than they were in the past 2 years. But we look at the most recent Charlotte Realtors Association data, and, we're still seeing this trend of very tight inventory. It fell 14% year over year, and we don't see that changing. Home builders are having a hard time finding land. There's so many barriers to entry right now to building new inventory.
Yeah.
This even ties into the national conversation with trade wars and the cost of materials and construction, all of things that are still grappling the housing market and creating these this tight inventory as well as these increases in sales pricing.
So because we have about 100 people a day moving here, and that seems to be the number that's floated around every time you talk about the growth of this area, they can't build fast enough, and that's why inventories are so low, and people don't want to put their currently owned homes on the market if they're going to stay in Charlotte because they don't know if they can find another place to live. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, we're not building enough homes. And like you said, people who have been in their homes for so long, if they were to move to a new house, they'd have to pay more, of course, for maybe a bigger home or the same amount or slightly more for the same exact house that they have today. And many people just aren't willing to do that. So they're holding on to their homes. They're staying in it longer and just not budging on the market.
Have we seen this before?
I think so. I mean, in every recession and economic expansion, the market ebbs and flows. But I think we're seeing this. It's just so extreme right now because there are so many factors in play. When you look at the trade wars, when you look at the growth that Charlotte is experiencing, which is just astronomical, there's just so many, even demographic dynamics are in play right now.
If there's no place to live, what does that do to job recruitment? I mean, if you may have a great job waiting for you someplace in Charlotte, but you look around, you come down here for the interview, they say, okay, it's yours. You go out with a real estate agent, you can't buy anything.
Well, I think that's just pushing our region farther and farther out, and that's just leading to longer commuting times.
Yeah, we also, a lot of the people that are moving here are relatively young. It's a big change for Charlotte, and a lot of those folks are renting, and a lot of them are living closer into town. But since you mentioned that 100 people a day, I think it's good to clarify that a little bit. It's actually more people than that move in.
Great.
Because we have... I always
more
say
traffic.
This is why the traffic's so bad, because it's about 130 that move here each day, but we lose some too. So
it's okay. We're building bicycle lanes. Don't worry.
Yeah,
about
but
it.
The
light rail guys.
But something that's a little different in this cycle is that, and it's all over the country, is that a larger proportion of the population is moving, wants to live closer into the city, because commute times have increased all over the country. And this expansion is unique in that only about 16 large metro areas have seen more people move to them than move away. And so we're one of those 16. And so the areas that are growing are all tending to grow very rapidly. They're all seeing these pressures on the housing prices.
I wonder what Pittsburgh is seeing. The city council went to Pittsburgh and see how they're doing. And they've lost as many people as we've gained. I wonder how they're doing.
Yeah, they all come down here. I mean, if you go down, they used to have a Pittsburgh Steelers watching party over at a bar just about a block from here.
Yeah. So is this good news from an economist's point of view? If you can't buy a house because nobody's buying or selling, even though interest rates are low and falling, what does that tell you?
Well,
about the economic health of this region.
This region is doing incredibly well. It is the economy has become more diverse. Even within the financial sector, we've become much more diverse because we have so many other companies that are doing business here than it used to be. Two large banks, and now we have several large banks and all sorts of other financial services firms.
Yeah.
So we have a very broad-based economy. We're one of the fastest-growing metro areas of the country. And what's really different is that we've become a top destination for young people and young college graduates. And that's who's filling up all of these apartments that are being built all over the city.
Mark Fittner is a senior economist for Wells Fargo. Ashley Fahey and Caroline Hudson both write about all of this in the pages of the Charlotte and online in the Charlotte Business Journal. We're going to take a break, come back and talk about the economy at large and about the world economy and about the probability or possibility of recession ahead. Stay with us. I'm Mike Collins. WFAE Charlotte Talks is hosting a public conversation to explore what can be done about the city's rising number of homicides. Only halfway through the year, Charlotte has already surpassed 2018's total. CMPD says this problem can't be law enforcement's alone to address, and they need your help. We examine the factors behind our homicide problem and what community leaders are doing to find solutions. Join us Tuesday, July 30th at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church at 7:30 for this important conversation. More at WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the health of the economy and where it's headed. Mark Vittner's here. He's a senior economist with Wells Fargo. Ashley Fahey and Caroline Hudson are reporters for the Charlotte Business Journal. The 3% growth in GDP is not what it was prior to the recession. It was much higher prior to the Great Recession. How would you characterize the health of GDP right now? What does that mean, Mark, to average people?
Well, GDP is the growth rate of the broader economy. It's the best measure that we have. It measures the volume of goods and services that are produced in the economy. And 3% growth is pretty good. And when you think about and comparing it over the course of business cycles, and this business cycle has seen the slowest average rate of GDP growth of any of the business cycles since World War II, but the base has gotten larger. And so it's larger.
I don't think I understand.
If we produce $20 trillion of goods and services, it takes more activity to get a 3% growth than if we produce $15 trillion of goods and services.
Okay.
And so, and that's essentially where, you know, we're producing more than $20 trillion of goods and services each year. So it's not surprising that the growth rate has moderated, but this expansion was unique in that it was very narrowly focused. As I mentioned earlier, only a handful of metro areas did very well. And growth from the start of the ending of the Great Recession was concentrated in three areas. It was in globally connected cities like New York and Miami and Seattle and LA. It was in, you know, well-defined tech centers like San Francisco and Seattle and Denver and Austin. Or it was in areas that had an energy boom. And if you weren't in one of those areas, you really didn't see much of recovery. What is somewhat unique is that Charlotte is not a well-defined energy sector. You don't think of it as being a tech center. And we do have a lot of international flights, but we're not a globally connected city just yet. We were somewhat an exception to that rule.
When Lowe's brings their tech center, essentially, to Southend in a couple of years, and they're supposedly going to have 2,000 six-figure employees at this tech center, does that make us a tech hub, Caroline?
I would say we're becoming a tech hub. That's how I would characterize that. Obviously, yes, you're going to have 2,000 tech jobs moving in here for Lowe's. You also have to consider Truist, and which is, he's laughing because I wanted to talk about this.
And by gosh, you are.
And I'm bringing it in. It relates, I promise. It relates. So for anybody who doesn't know, Truist is the new name for the combined SunTrust and BB&T. That's the name they came out with. And the reason I bring that up is because this new bank that they're creating says they are going to bring a tech innovation hub to Charlotte as well. Okay. And so not a lot of details right now about what that will look like, even where it will be. But I think that's significant that these large companies are starting to notice Charlotte for tech talent and the tech talent that we will have in the future.
Something interesting, though, about that Lowe's deal, the whole thing with them, and they've worked on this for a year and a half before they decided on Charlotte, and of course incentives were part of it, but you know, it took a long time for them to be convinced that Charlotte did have the tech talent and the pipeline to fill those jobs. They had to work with a bunch of local groups here, a bunch of companies here, to be convinced that they could hire that many people here.
Why did they think that they could, when Amazon did not?
Well, that's the thing. You know, we had this whole big thing fall out when Amazon said, well, we just don't think Charlotte is a tech market. And of course, that was a big PR thing, and that was a big headline thing in the local market. But when Lowe's came in, they were just like, well, we're just not convinced. You know, we can go to Dallas, and we know we can hire it in Dallas. Dallas has a bigger pool. But the thing with Charlotte is Charlotte has the pipeline. So in, you may go to a market like Dallas and you could poach, you know, 2,000 workers from other firms. But what the argument here is there's a pipeline that you can draw from with all the millennials moving here.
And I tell you, one of the things that surprised me with the Truist move is one of the stats they cited was that young college-educated millennials more moved to Charlotte than moved to Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
So that and
because the cost of living is lower? Why?
I think it's just that Atlanta is choking on some of its own success, and that it's still growing awfully fast. And they had more people move to Atlanta than move to Charlotte, but they just weren't in that key college-educated millennial.
Well, getting back to this idea that there's no pipe, that they had to be convinced that there was a pipeline to bring in tech talent that they would need for their tech center. I mean, this is the 21st century. People move every day. I mean, if you post on Indeed a job opening of 2,000 people, they will come, won't they?
You would think so, but you know, when you're a big company making that big of an investment, you really have to make absolutely sure that you can get those jobs. And not every metro can provide 2,000 tech jobs.
People change jobs not like they change their socks. Of course they would come.
Well,
they're six-figure jobs.
They're probably only going to come to areas that they're going to, that like-minded people are going to. Because if you're going to move somewhere, you want to have options. You don't want to be stranded in that. In that city, you want to have more than one option, and so there is something to the to getting enough momentum. I think the one thing that folks have done a better job of uncovering is that we've always been thought of as a big finance town, and most of the jobs that have been added in financial services over the last decade have been in technology. They actually haven't been in traditional banking roles, and so there's a lot more tech workers here than people realize.
I'm going to get back a little to GDP and other aspects of the economy. Again, Market Watch says the Federal Reserve is concerned that trade clashes with China and other countries have hurt farmers, manufacturers, and exporters, crimped business investment, and slowed the economy. And that, some people say that those concerns have led to a weak outlook for growth in the future, which could discourage business spending and be a contributing factor to a manufacturing slowdown. Is that what you see happening?
Well, that's what I see happening, but I think that the Market Watch piece missed a big part of that, and that is that China is the largest market for new automobiles in the world. And ever since the trade dispute has come about, their auto sales have fallen every month. Germany and Japan supply lots of things to the Chinese auto market. Because China's auto market has slowed, their economies have weakened. And the German long bond, their 10-year bond, is yielding minus 0.4%. In fact, there are high-yield corporate bonds in Europe with negative interest rates on them. That's how much their economies have slowed due to this trade dispute. So just looking at what's happening with U.S. farmers, I mean, we haven't seen anywhere near the slowdown that the rest of the world has, but that slowdown in the rest of the world is weighing on our factory sector.
Well, what are the tariffs, the threat of tariffs? Because I don't know that outside of certain farm products that tariffs are raging as much as the president would like to have us think that they are. Maybe I'm wrong about that. How much impact are they having on the economy? How much of a drag on the economy?
Well, they haven't had a huge drag on the U.S. economy, mainly because a lot of businesses got out ahead of the tariffs and they imported goods very quickly and stored them in inventory. And a lot of the Chinese suppliers actually made up for the tariff in 2018. And they said, as we get into the new year, we want to split the tariff with you 50-50. And so what we saw is a huge buildup in inventories, which actually added to GDP in the first quarter. We're beginning to see that draw down now. But tariffs are on a whole lot of things. Even in the price of a home, I mean, most of your lighting is made in China. A lot of the appliances are made in China. A lot of the woodwork is imported from China, and so even in the price of a home, tariffs have knocked on a lot of paints and veneers, all that stuff.
So how is this helping our trade deficit? Because obviously they don't pay the tariff unless they want to split it with us 50-50 by cutting prices. We pay the tariff. So how is this helping?
Well, they have absorbed a lot of the tariff. They have eaten, to date, they've eaten most of the tariff, which has shown up in smaller profit margins for Chinese manufacturers. It's one of the reasons why it hasn't been evident in our inflation
data. Is that why China's reporting slower growth?
That's part of it. The other thing is that a lot of companies are moving production out of China, either back to the United States or to other nations
in Asia. Is that what we want? Is that the real motivation behind tariffs?
That's,
to bring these companies back?
That's one of the motivations. The real motivation behind tariffs is that China has not followed through on the commitments that they made, when the United States and other nations allowed them to join the World Trade Organization on a permanent basis in 1999. They were supposed to provide market access to the Chinese market. They were supposed to provide intellectual property protections, and they haven't done it. And so the U.S. isn't asking China to do anything new. They're just asking them to follow through on the commitments that they made to the U.S. and the rest of the world back in 1999. And the sticking point seems to be that they don't want to have any kind of ramification, any kind of punishment that that goes on if they don't meet those commitments. And that's what they can't come to an agreement on.
So, Ashley, we just talked about how we can't build enough homes fast enough, and although they are building homes. You see them all over the place.
Sure.
But what have these tariffs done? If all the things that Mark just mentioned, the building supplies and appliances and things like that, they go into new homes,
mm-hmm.
what impact is that having on home builders?
It's obviously impacting their bottom lines, and they're therefore having to ask more money for a house that, you know, just a couple of years ago would have sold for a lot less. Add that in with the market currently and the demand. I mean, you're just seeing home prices increase exponentially. You know, we saw a 7.1% increase in sales prices year over year with the most recent Charlotte Regional Realtors Association data. And I don't see that trend changing. I mean, as this continues, as these tariffs and as the cost of materials and construction and even labor, I mean, it's so hard to hire for people in the construction trades, we're just going to continue to see that pressure on pricing.
So go ahead.
I think if I might just jump in here, one point I did want to make, and Mark alluded to this earlier, I think obviously a lot of people are uncomfortable with the prospect of trade wars and tariffs, but you also have to consider the relative sizes of the economies we're talking about here. I believe, Mark, you said earlier, U.S. is at $20 trillion. Is that correct? Roughly? Very rough. Which is nowhere – China is nowhere near that size. And so whether you are pro or against these trade wars and tariffs, one thing you have to agree on is that the U.S. definitely has the leverage here.
But how is this helping us? I mean, if it's raising the cost of houses, it's causing everything to be more expensive for us. Is this short-term pain for long-term gain?
That's the idea, is to bring out a meaningful change in trade relations with China. I don't know whether it'll happen or not, but even folks that are not generally in favor of tariffs are saying we're so far along this road right now, let's just hope it works. And so if we're going to get a deal with China, it's probably going to be late this year or early next year. If not, they're probably going to wait to see what happens with the U.S. presidential election and see if they have a better option after that. But that's not the primary reason that home prices are rising. The primary reason that home prices are rising is that land costs have risen dramatically, and impact fees and environmental costs have increased dramatically. And that's what's really pushed up the price of housing. The tariffs are just another add-on, another nuisance, and we have a housing affordability crisis in virtually every part of the country that's growing. Any place that anybody wants to live, mm-hmm. housing prices are rising very, very rapidly. And so the tariffs just adds on to that and makes it a little bit worse.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that the president likes to talk about is interest rates, and he has been goading the Federal Reserve into lowering interest rates. Forbes says that this push on the part of President Trump for lower interest rates is because of his builder-developer mindset, because in that world, interest rates drop, profits rise, and that's how he thinks. But it has been proven that lower interest rates do not result in economic growth. In fact, they can cause investors to take inordinate risks and companies to make unsound acquisitions or expenditures. That's what Forbes says. Do you agree?
I don't know that you can generalize it to that degree. I do think that lower interest rates would help the economy right now, because I think the Fed went a little too far last year. It would also be helpful if the president didn't speak as much about the Federal Reserve as he does, because I think that folks are kind of resigned to the fact that this guy loves to tweet, and you know you're gonna get. And I think that Powell probably understands it too, but it does
He's the chair of the Federal Reserve.
Yes, okay. I think I should have said Chairman Powell, but Chair Powell. He understands it. Kind of goes with the territory. I don't think that it's going to influence Fed policy. I don't think the reason that Powell is looking to cut the federal funds rate is because the president would like it. But one area that will benefit is home building, because home builders borrow money short term. They borrow it on the short term. And that is meaningful for them. And I think that the sooner the Fed cuts rates, and no sooner than July 31st, but they're going to cut it July 31st, we'll probably see that housing starts pick up after that.
Because if you cut interest rates for people who take out mortgages, you can buy more house. So that means that could offset the rising costs of a home? Maybe.
Good. Absolutely.
Consumers are spending. Business is not. What should we make of that? I don't know which one of you wants to take that question.
Well,
What do businesses know that consumers do not?
There's a perception that businesses are not spending because they're not buying lots of industrial equipment, but what they are buying is lots of software. And they're also outsourcing their IT needs, and they're putting that into the cloud. And so there's third-party providers that are growing that. The intellectual property portion of business fixed investment grew at a 12% annual rate in the last quarter. And that's displacing a lot of capital investment in other parts of the economy. So I'm not so sure that businesses aren't increasing capital investment. I think folks are looking for that increase in capital investment in all the wrong places. When I look at the adoption of Salesforce in our own business, Salesforce software, jobs did that displace? How much equipment did that displace? How many square feet of office space did that displace? And so that means less capital investment in the things that we used to measure, but more of it in the software side.
Expectations are that June will reveal that there will be modest growth in retail sales, and that means people are spending money at the consumer level. That certainly reflects consumer confidence, but are they spending money that they have, or are they putting it all on a credit card? Caroline.
Well, I think not necessarily are they spending money that they have, but that's also another factor. When you have a healthy economy, people take out more lines of credit. They feel more confident that they will be able to pay that back. So I think that's just a side effect of a healthy economy. I think when you have to start worrying is when the default rates rise. That's what you have to watch when, you know, it doesn't matter if people are taking out more lines of credit. That's actually a good thing, especially for the banks. The problem comes when they're not getting that money back.
And if you're in a situation like Charlotte, where it's difficult to buy a home because it's difficult to find a home, that suppresses furniture sales and drapery sales and appliance sales. Is that what we're seeing happening in Charlotte?
I don't know if you can drill down that specifically, but sure. I mean, anytime you're not seeing that movement, it does affect other industries, and it does have a ripple effect, if you will. Even on the commercial side, you're seeing all these towers being built. You're seeing 13 towers that are more than 100,000 square feet are proposed or under construction just in Uptown and South End. But what those, tenant upfit costs are going to be, what companies that are, pre-leasing or taking the anchor space for these buildings, what they're spending per square foot, I mean, that's all going to be, dramatically impacted by these national forces we're seeing.
That's Ashley Fahey. She's a reporter for the Charlotte Business Journal. She's here with Caroline Hudson, also with the Business Journal, and Mark Vittner, senior economist for Wells Fargo. We have to take a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the economy and what it looks like for the first half of 2019, heading into the second half of 2019. I forgot the year for a second.
It's easy to do that.
That's not a good sign. Mark Vittner, senior economist for Wells Fargo, is here along with Ashley Fahey and Caroline Hudson from the Charlotte Business Journal. The U.S. economy is doing okay, but the global economy has slowed. How are the two interrelated, and why is Europe and Japan suffering in relation to the United States?
Well, when you look at how exposed an economy is to the rest of the world, you want to look at how big their trade sector is. In the U.S., our trade sector is relatively small, particularly if you exclude Canada and Mexico. And a lot of the trade that takes place in those countries are goods and services that cross the border multiple times. But trade accounts for a very small proportion of the U.S. economy, accounts for a very large proportion of the German economy. And And to some of the other economies, the Italian economy trades pretty big, and the French economy is pretty big, but the German economy is the biggest in Europe, and trade as a share of their GDP is probably the highest of any industrialized nation, and so the slowdown in China really reverberates through there, and that's where the pain from the trade dispute is really playing out. It's really playing out in Germany and Japan, and their interest rates have dropped to really unbelievable levels.
But if we're imposing tariffs on China, why isn't China just simply going to Germany and trading with them as opposed to us?
Well, they are trading with Germany, but the problem is that the U.S. is such a large economy. Mm. It's such a large economy globally that by slowing exports to the U.S., their economy is slowing in a big way. And then it's also added an element of uncertainty in China. And as I mentioned, we sell about 17 million new cars and light trucks a year. In China, they sell around 25 million, and their car sales, their motor vehicle sales, have dropped every single month for the last 18 months. And their consumers have pulled back in a very significant way. And so they're seeing it both on the trade front and domestically with domestic demand in China's weakened.
Well, the probability model used by the New York Fed to calculate – I don't know what I'm talking about here. I just read this.
You sound great, Mike.
Yeah. The probability model used by the New York Fed to calculate the odds of a recession in the next 12 months just hit 32%, which is the highest level since 2009. And they say that a reading above 30% has preceded all recent recessions. Should we be girding our loins?
Well, you know, a lot of that, their model is built, a lot of that has to do with the inversion of the yield curve, where long-term rates have dropped below short-term rates. And every recession that we've had since World War II has been preceded by an inversion of the yield curve. But there have been two times where the yield curve is inverted and we didn't have a recession. And a lot of folks are saying that this time will probably be the third, because the reason that our yield curve is inverted is that German bonds have dropped to minus 0.4%, so they're nearly negative by a half a percentage point, and the spread between U.S. and German rates has widened, and so a lot of investors in Europe are saying, I need to get some yield, and they're buying U.S. bonds and pulling the interest rates down. So that's what's caused our curve to invert. It hasn't been worries about the economy so much.
So nationally, Caroline, polls show that 40% of Americans feel that we are already in a recession, or one will absolutely soon begin. More Democrats believe that than Republicans. Perhaps that is wishful thinking. I don't know, because that would impact the election.
It could be.
But why do you think that people in Charlotte think that we are already in a recession?
I really don't think so. I mean, people have been worried about an impending recession for the past 2 or 3 years, really. I mean, it's essentially just waiting for the shoe to drop. But, you know, you also run the risk of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. When you do fear it so much, you stop, businesses stop, banks stop lending, people stop taking out credit, they stop spending. So you also have to watch that. But I really think, overall, analysts still feel that the economy's strong, it's doing well, we shouldn't worry just yet. I mean, at the end of the day, economic cycles happen. There will be a recession. That's 100%. Everyone can agree on that. But I don't think it's coming in the next year.
Well, I have all this good economic news, all these economic indicators that are pretty good. Low inflation, low unemployment, the slump in housing prices, except maybe in Charlotte, low interest rates, U.S. consumers, you would think would be in high cotton, but they're not, because after accounting for inflation, most workers today have the same purchasing power they had 40 years ago. It's not trickling down. Why not?
Well, those statistics are a little misleading, because they look at the median, and most people are at a different point in their life today than they were 40 years ago, and so they're not necessarily the same people. And the median income numbers also look at income from wages and salaries, and we didn't have 401ks 40 years ago.
No, we had pensions, guaranteed pensions.
Well, for people that were working in those
and healthcare
that were working in those industries, and so the non-cash portion of income is significantly higher today than it was then. So it's not really an apples to apples comparison.
So if workers and consumers were benefiting from all of this, in other words, if salaries had gone up, if we were getting more than if we hadn't stagnated for 40 years, how much better would the economy be? You could buy more stuff.
Oh, yeah, you could. And you know, we went through this, and I had written a piece about this in the Great Recession. I said, you know, the slowdown really began with the energy crisis in 73. And so we went from single-income households to dual-income households. That took us for a while. And then after both people were working, our incomes were stagnating. So we put the house to work. And then, you know, we leveraged ourselves to the hilt. And, you know, it didn't work too well. And so, yeah, it certainly it has created some difficulty. But over the last 4 years, we've actually seen median household income rise pretty solidly. And we've had very strong growth because inflation's been low. Income growth has picked up. We've had pretty good years the last 4 years.
I want to interrupt this conversation because we have some breaking news this morning. Charlotte Mecklenburg School Superintendent Clayton Wilcox is apparently no longer on the job after meeting with school board leaders this morning. Reached by phone, Superintendent Wilcox declined to say what was discussed. He referred all comments to school board leadership and that he had been told not to discuss his status. This is a familiar way of doing business at the school board. And joining us now with more is WFAE's education reporter, Ann Dawes Helms. First of all, welcome on board, Ann, and what do we know?
Thanks. It's good to be back. We know that Friday there was a special called meeting of the school board to discuss Superintendent Wilcox's evaluation. It lasted 5 hours. They came out and didn't say anything, according to the Observer's Annie Ma. This morning, there was a meeting between some board leaders and Superintendent Wilcox, and when I reached him by phone shortly after that and asked him about reports we had heard that he was suspended pending termination, he said, "I just can't discuss that. I need to refer all comments to board leadership. Tracy Russ, the chief of communications, is also saying we can't confirm his job status right now. We will give you that when it comes from HR." All of that points to some pretty serious action going on.
Yeah, WBTV's education reporter Dedrick Russell recently reported that Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools stopped fingerprinting new employees for about a year. Is this playing into this? Evidently, the school board was unaware of this. Is this playing into this, do you think?
Well, and I have not done a lot of reporting on that. I think that it is fair to say that that is at least a factor in this. A lot of times, when something comes to the point where there may be talk of suspension or termination, it's not just one huge incident. It may be a series of incidents in the way they've been handled. That's kind of what I've heard is going on here. We are obviously going to be looking hard for more details. We don't have to look very far back to remember a precedent for this when Heath Morrison was superintendent and was rather abruptly announced that he was resigning to go home and take care of his sick mother. We, of course, quickly found out that that was not the case, that he had been pressured to resign because of some pretty serious accusations against him. So I am hoping that the board will be upfront about what's going on. I think, you know, this is a huge deal for the community. This is 6 weeks before school starts. If he does end up not being the person who's going forward in leadership, they don't have a deputy superintendent. He's never named a deputy superintendent. It is a school board election year, so Mary McRae, who's been the chair for 7 years, is essentially a lame duck. They're going to have some new leadership in starting in November. They have crucial positions open. They never essentially filled the HR position, human resources position, on a permanent basis. They have a loaner from a bank. The Central District 1, Denise Watts, very well known, did a lot of leadership on high-poverty schools, on equity issues. She has left, and her replacement has not been named. There's a lot of really important stuff going on that they're going to need to reassure the community about what's happening.
So has this been brewing for a while? You cover this. You've been covering this for as long as you've been alive. So has this been brewing for a while? Have you noticed? Have there been noticeable tension points between Clayton Wilcox and the school board?
Well, off and on, there always have been. And I think that's not necessarily a huge thing. I think there are always tension points between a board and a leader. I think the board really, really wanted and perhaps still wants this to work. You know, they have had 5 superintendents in the last 10 years. If they have to do another search, it will be the 4th search within 10 years. They're very worried about getting the reputation as a district that can't either pick the right person or keep the right person. These most recent weeks, I have not been actively reporting, so I don't know as much what has happened recently, but
we still don't know why Heath Morrison, who I believe was the superintendent prior to Ann Clark, who was interim and then appointed and then retired, and that she was replaced with Clayton Wilcox. We still don't know why he was let go, and he was a shining darling of the city and the school board, et cetera, until he wasn't. Will we know ever what's going on with Clayton Wilcox? Because they play these cards very close to the vest.
They do play them very close to the vest. And I think it is likely that there will be some negotiations going on, possibly as we are speaking, about how this is resolved. And I believe with Heath Morrison and the board, they signed a non-disparagement, non-disclosure, mutual agreement. That didn't mean that we didn't get a lot of information. And I think we actually know quite a bit about why Heath Morrison left. It is not public record. If they have a report done by their attorneys, it can be covered by attorney-client privilege. I believe that's probably what's going to happen this time. It is definitely what happened last time. Didn't mean we didn't get a copy of that report. So we did see that they had some serious concerns about his following board policies. They had outlined, and in that case it was George Battle, their in-house counsel, who had written a report outlining what he believed were several causes for termination. And in that case, Heath Morrison decided to resign rather than fight it or, you know, face termination. And Heath Morrison was the one who asked that they essentially give a cover story. He told me that. I think he was quite open about that. But it just tends to not work to try to pat the public on the head and say, don't worry about this. I mean, this is, you know, one of our major civic institutions. And Clayton Wilcox has a lot of fans out there. You know, he has some people who are not so crazy about him, but he has, I think, won over a lot of teachers who feel like he's really been a voice for them. So there, people are going to really want to know what's happening here. And, of course, we will be trying to find that out, and I suspect a lot of people will be.
So as of this moment in time, where do we stand with Clayton Wilcox?
Well, we stand that we have a superintendent who cannot confirm whether he is actively in the job. We have, you know, a district that can't confirm or deny whether he is actively in the job or whether he is suspended or I think it's unlikely that he is flat out terminated. That is a process.
And the school board have you?
Gwendolyn, Glenn and I have been making a lot of calls this morning. We're not getting a lot of calls returned. I'm sure they are trying to figure out how to coordinate this. They kind of had a session in how not to do this with Heath Morrison. They gave a story that was quickly revealed to be not true. Then they held a press conference that lasted like 4 minutes in which they came out and said, we're not going to tell you anything more. You know, they have a new communications person since then, Tracy Russ. I think he gets the concept. I think they all get the concept that people want answers, but they're going to have to really be careful about how and what they say. And by the way, if you are on Facebook, you can go to Clayton Wilcox's personal Facebook page. At 6 o'clock on Saturday, he posted a long statement with a collection of pictures from his time in which he said he had just turned off his phone and been reflecting on his 2 years here, and here are all the wonderful things he's accomplished. You know, I think a lot of us looked at that and said, wow, he's either fighting for his job or he's essentially writing his own career obituary.
Wow. Andos Helms, our new education reporter at WFAE News. Thank you. Stay tuned. We'll have more details as they become available to us throughout the day here on WFAE. And thank you very much.
Appreciate thank you.
It. I want to go back very quickly and just for a few minutes with our guests on our what we've been talking about with the economy here in Charlotte and around the country with Mark Vittner from Wells Fargo, Ashley Fahey and Caroline Hudson from the Charlotte Business Journal. Given all the things that we've talked about the market, the interest rates, unemployment here nationally is 3.5%, the lowest in 50 years. What's our rate here? Do we know in Charlotte or in the region or in North Carolina?
You know, in Charlotte, it's a little bit higher because we have such strong population growth, and so I believe it's 4.1%.
Yeah, it's
right
around
now.
Around four, yeah.
And North Carolina earned another high ranking from a business climate study. We're listed at number 3 in CNBC's 13th annual America's Top States for Business, trailing only Virginia and Texas. In fact, CNBC said that there's no state's economy on more solid ground than ours. Do you agree? And if so, why, in the 40 seconds we have left?
Well, I mean, you see all the economic development announcements we've had lately, definitely competitive business climate. We've proven to be a little bit more competitive with incentives than we have in the past. So I think all those things are contributing. Add in low cost of living compared to other metros and all the other things that particularly Charlotte and Raleigh have going for it. And it, the outlook does look rosy, at least for the short term.
Are we optimistic?
Fairly. I say optimistic, but cautious.
Same thing. Are the people that you talk to in business optimistic?
Businesses are certainly optimistic from what I'm hearing. Yes.
Mark, what about the rest of the
country? I'm optimistic, but I'm well aware that the success has not been shared equally across the state or even across the spectrum here in Charlotte.
Okay. Mark Vittner, senior economist for Wells Fargo, Ashley Fahey and Caroline Hudson. Excuse me, reporters. I'm all choked up.
Careful
for the
there.
Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for joining us.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.